Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects we all struggle with in this conversation with a reluctant therapist. Good afternoon, Elizabeth.
Good afternoon, Hank. I am so happy to be here today, and I hope that you're going to hang around for today's conversation because I think it's right up your alley. It is. I think it's something that is of great importance to everyone, anyone who inhabits this planet or is part of this human economy, this human experience, and
that
also
sounds just like me.
Doesn't it? I mean, you are a grand supporter of the human experience. But yeah, this is going to be a wonderful hour of conversation. I actually have a guest here, not in the studio, but with us. And we're going to be talking about an upcoming Central Coast Annual Women's Symposium that's happening on March the 14th, Saturday, March the 14th at the San Luis Coastal Adult School. And my guest, Dr. Rianne Eisler, is going to come down and talk about what is good for women is good for the world. That will be her topic for the Women's Symposium. So I'm extremely excited about this. Because if you're not familiar with Dr. Eisler's work, she is probably best known as the author of the groundbreaking book, The Chalice and the Blade, Our History, which is now in 25 foreign editions. And this book was seminal in kind of exposing and exploring how we went from being a partnership culture of revering both men and women to a more domination-based or patriarchal culture. And I remember reading this book probably back in 1990, and it was one of those pieces that changed the direction of my life and brought me to this work and brought me to doing the work I do today, teaching at Cal Poly and doing this show. And so I'm excited and honored to have Dr. Eisler here. And as always, we are going to have the phones open throughout the show. If you have any questions that you'd like to ask or if you have any comments you'd like to share, our number is 805-781-3875. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And you can also be part of the conversation on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, or at our website, thereluctanttherapist.com. You can always send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. There's a lot of ways to be involved, and we really like to hear from you and know what's on your mind. So without further ado, I would like to introduce Dr. Rianne Eisler. She is the president of the Center for Partnership Studies and is internationally known, as I mentioned, for her groundbreaking book, The Chalice and the Blade, Our History. She also has another book titled The Real Wealth of Nations, Creating a Caring Economics, which was hailed by Archbishop Desmond Tutu as a template for the better world we've all been urgently seeking. Gloria Steinem said this was revolutionary, and Jane Goodall called this book a call to action. Dr. Eisler is a member of the Club of Rome, a counselor of the World Future Council, and the International Museum of Women. She's a member of the General Evolution Research Group. She is also the founder of the Caring Economy Campaign. She keynotes conferences all over the world and sits on many boards and councils. She is the co-founder of the Spiritual Alliance to Stop Intimate Violence with Nobel Peace Laureate Betty Williams and has received many honors for her work for peace and human rights. Her work in the world is so profound that she was named one of the 20 most influential thinkers of our time. So as you can imagine, I'm honored to have Dr. Eisler on the air with us today. Welcome, Dr. Eisler.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Elizabeth.
So I have so many questions to ask, and I don't want to run out of time, but I also don't want to overwhelm you or everyone else. So I'm going to try to focus on your keynote address for the Women's Symposium: What is Good for Women is Good for the World. And when you and I were talking earlier, what I mentioned to you is the whole idea that we're still fighting a fight for women seems foreign to a lot of the younger generation. That, you know, in teaching at Cal Poly, I do a lot of talking to young people and talk about the importance of feminism and caring for the planet and caring for the caregivers. And the response I get quite often is, didn't the feminist movement already happen? Why are we still having this conversation? Everyone's equal now. Women are, you know, the dominating force in colleges and in the economy. So why are we still talking about feminism?
Well, I think that there's a lot of misinformation out there. For one thing, we really have we have come a long way, which is something that really young people don't even understand. A generation ago, for example, the want ads were segregated into help wanted women and help wanted men, with all the dead end jobs, really, you know, the helper, the secretary, etc., under help wanted women, and all the good jobs under help wanted male. So even before you got to the, you know, to knock on that door, it was barred. I wrote a brief to the Supreme Court because I also, aside from my background as a social and systems scientist, I have a legal background. I wrote a brief, a friend of the court brief, to the Supreme Court of the United States, arguing what was in the early 70s a radical notion that women should be considered persons under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. So, yes, we have moved forward, but as you can really ask almost any woman who is a mother and also has an outside job, we have a long way to go. We're the only nation, these United States, in the developing world, that doesn't have a paid parental leave that's government-supported. So this notion that, yes, that this is a post-feminist age, it's a very nice way of maintaining what I call a domination system.
Well, and say more about that, because I think, you know, this, as long as we keep having this fantasy or this idea that the feminist movement is over, that equality has been achieved, you know, that we see this very small bubble of women who have achieved equality or achieve success on some level. But for the great majority of women, they're still struggling in many ways, trying to balance work and motherhood and tending to a family and not having the opportunities. I mean, we look at this tiny bubble of women who are actually achieving, and we think that's happening everywhere, but clearly it's not. And so isn't this idea that women are achieving making it even more easy to exploit women?
Well, even the women who are privileged are really finding that we have to move to really what I call a second phase in the feminist movement. You know, in the first part of it, it was about getting a bigger slice of the existing economic pie. But now we're at a place where, to continue with this woman's metaphor, we really have to work together with enlightened men, mm-hmm. because this is not an issue of women against men, to really bake a better pie, to change the economic rules of the game, which were actually constructed without taking into account the needs, the aspirations, the contributions of the female half of humanity, and all too often without even taking into account the humanity of either women or men. So we have an economic heritage where the two principal theories, you know, capitalist and socialist theory, consider the work of caring for people in households, or for that matter, caring for our Mother Earth, as just reproductive rather than productive work. So GDP, which is based on these assumptions, doesn't count as productive the enormous contribution, financial contribution, of the work still primarily performed by women in homes, caring for children, the sick, the elderly. There was a recent Australian survey that showed that if that work were included, it would constitute 50% of the reported Australian GDP. Now, this is not some little thing. This is a major flaw that really militates against both women and men who want to and who need to. I mean, with the graying of our population, you have a huge issue of elder care. Again, so when I wrote a piece for the Shriver Report, which found, by the way, the 2014 Shriver report found that 1/3 of American women either live in poverty or are on the brink. I wrote a piece for it showing that one of the main reasons for this is that we as a nation do not support care work. And until we do, to talk about having achieved the goals of equality, which I think is really, it's not just a question of equality using the old norm, it's equality using a new norm. That's what we're talking about. And a lot of men, I mean, that's the good news, are today, you know, really also wanting to spend more time with their families. So, yes, what's good for women is good for the world.
And can you talk a little bit, Dr. Eisler, about how did we, a little the historical perspective, how we got to this place of a dominator culture, which I think is the same or maybe not as a patriarchal culture, as we quite often call it. And I think I read that you said, no, the opposite of the patriarchal culture is not a matriarch, but the opposite of the patriarch is a partnership. So how did we go from being in ancient cultures a partnership to a domination culture that we are today? And how do we get back?
Well, we don't want to go back, and I'm so glad you brought up that point, which I emphasize in all my writings, and that's why I use domination system and partnership system rather than patriarchy and matriarchy, because really, patriarchy and matriarchy, if you think about it, whether it's controlled by fathers or controlled by mothers, it's two sides of the same coin, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And what we're talking about and what actually is reflected in the archaeological and mythical record is what I call a partnership system, not ideal, not a utopia, but a system in which both halves of humanity have equal status. And just to give you one example of earlier cultures, probably the most, the largest Neolithic, and that is, about 7,000 to 9,000 year old, early agrarian site ever excavated is called Çatalhöyük. And it's in Turkey on the Anatolia Plateau. And the man who is currently excavating there wrote an article for the Scientific American where, with some amazement, he said that this is really a culture in which being born male or female didn't seem to make that much of a difference in terms of status, in terms of wealth, in terms of partnership, really. So we do have that heritage, and it goes back into our gathering hunting days. There's a whole literature much more recent now than when I wrote The Chalice and the Blade, about how gathering hunting tribes tend to be more egalitarian, starting with a more equal partnership between women and men. But there was a shift in our prehistory. There are many theories about it. The evidence in at least the areas around the Mediterranean, which I've studied primarily, so-called Western early civilization, are that it happened during a period of great climate changes, desertification, aridification, where already marginal areas became more and more uninhabitable, where farming was no longer possible, herding, which, of course, despoils the environment even more because it doesn't, you know, it just takes away the you know, the grasslands, and where these people then came in and invaded. And I write about that in The Chalice and the Blade. There are other books about it. But the main thing is this. This happened during a time of great disequilibrium. And we know from chaos theory, from nonlinear dynamics, and from other new approaches to understanding complex systems that it is during periods of great instability, disequilibrium, that you can have fundamental change. And that happened in our prehistory. But now, and this is the good news, and this is the important part that I emphasize again and again, with the shift first from agrarian to industrial technology and now much more rapidly to post-industrial knowledge service technology, you're seeing another very period of great dislocation, and we have been moving more towards the partnership side. And yes, the feminist movement is a very important part of that, as is the civil rights movement, the environmental movement. All of these challenge traditions of domination, don't they? The economic justice movement. But it's been against and continues to be against enormous resistance and, yes, periodic regressions. So if we look at what's been happening in recent times as an not as a linear upward process, but a spiral upward movement with dips, we can see that it's really up to us, isn't it, to help build the foundations for a partnership system. And that's what so much of my work now is about.
If you're just tuning in, this is my guest, Dr. Rian Eisler, talking about what is good for women is good for the world, her keynote address that she'll be sharing with the Central Coast Annual Women's Symposium, March the 14th at the San Luis Coastal Adult School. If you're interested in attending, you can find out information at spiritualcircle.org. /symposium. And this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. I'm having a hard time finding my words, Dr. Eisler, because I'm so caught up in this idea that you talked about not moving in a linear form, you know, because we tend to think of things as happening in a linear space where we just are changing and changing and changing. But the idea of the spiral, where we actually have been moving towards this partnership quite a bit since the civil rights movement and the feminist movement, with the dips, as you mentioned, and we're moving towards a new world of more partnership because men and women are starting to understand that there's great value in the nurturing and caring part of the life experience. So I think that leads into your work around the caring economy. And can you talk a bit about your book and this idea of why we need to shift to a caring economy as opposed to where we are now?
Well, in my first books, drawing from my research across cultural historical research on really what are the underlying issues in terms of moving to that more peaceful and more equitable system that we also want and need, I really focus on trying to understand. And part of it was trying to understand how we got here.
Mm-hmm.
Then I started to really focus much more on, well, what are the interventions, the fundamental changes that we need to make, mm-hmm, in order for us to really accelerate and support this movement towards the partnership end of the continuum. And it's always a matter of degree. That's why I talk about a partnership domination continuum. And you're quite right. It has not been a linear process, mm-hmm, although it's very clear that, I mean, I sometimes as a joke say that when I get depressed, I think of the European Middle Ages. Why? Because they look a lot like the Taliban, don't they? The Inquisition, the, mm-hmm, Crusades, the witch burnings, women had no rights, children had no rights. You know, it was awful. But we have moved forward, but it's always, the domination system has rebuilt itself, whether it was Nazi Germany, whether it was, whether it is what we're seeing today with ISIS. I mean, but one of the striking things about both of these seemingly very different examples is that for both of them, and this is really fundamental, this is about building the foundations, for both of them, a dominator family is key. One of their top priorities is getting women back into their so-called traditional, which is a code word for subservient, mm-hmm, place in a rigidly male-dominated, highly punitive family, mm-hmm, where children not only have a model of our species where one half is considered superior and considered, you know, domination is the role, right? And the other half is to be dominated. One half is to be served. The other half is to do the serving. And where children also learn that it's very painful, very, very painful to question orders, no matter how unjust. So a lot of my work has focused on the foundations, mm-hmm. Parent-child relations, gender relations, and, yes, economic relations. So I'm finally getting to your question.
Well, because I think it's important to understand that we have a lot of conversations about the gender inequalities. We have a lot of conversations about human rights, but we rarely tie those to the economic issue. I mean, we have a lot of conversations about pay inequality, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. But I think this idea of what drives culture, and in Western cultures and actually throughout the world, the economy, which is what has power, right? How we make the money is where the power is. So I think that's where this conversation about the caring economy is so important.
Well, and that's why I wrote my book, The Real Wealth of Nations, Creating a Caring Economy. Mm-hmm. And the premise of that book is basically that what we need cannot be offered by either capitalist or socialist theory by itself or practice. Why? For one thing, both came out of industrial times, and we're now well into the post-industrial knowledge service age, you know, with all kinds of new technologies, including automation, robotics. Artificial intelligence is coming down the way, right? I mean, it's a different era. And that's one of, things we have to take into consideration. But also, both those theories came out of times that oriented still much more to the domination side of the continuum. So as I said, you know, the work of caring, of caregiving, was relegated to reproductive rather than productive work, even though we have a very strong argument, and I make that argument through our project of the Center for Partnership Studies Caring Economy campaign, that for the post-industrial knowledge service age, the most important capital, and this is what economists keep telling us, is what they call high-quality human capital. Mm-hmm. In other words, human capacity development. And we know from neuroscience that if we don't invest in good care for children, in early childhood education that's high quality, we're not going to have that high-quality human capital. Mm-hmm. So the point of it is that we have to try to change the system both from inside by using an economic benefits argument, which is what we do through the Caring Economy campaign, through my book, The Real Wealth of Nations, as well as from the outside with creative ideas of how can we really shift the values, because economic systems are about what's valued. And the problem is that we have had a hidden system of gendered valuations where anything stereotypically associated with women and the so-called feminine, the soft, mm-hmm. is considered less valuable than anything stereotypically associated with what in domination systems is considered real masculinity, you know, conquest, domination, right? You know, the so-called hard values. So unless we really unpack that and make it visible, we cannot move to what we want to move to. And so I have really focused on changing how we look at economics. And, of course, the good news is that there's beginning to be more and more talk about giving visibility and value to the work of care. And I make the argument that this is not only essential for those who do most of this work, women, and to relieve. Well, I mean, globally, women are the mass of the world's poor and the poorest of the poor, and one of the main reasons for it is the devaluation of this work, right? But also, if we are to have a successful economy in our post-industrial knowledge service age.
This is Dr. Rianne Eisler. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is a conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. And we're talking about the shift this subtle shift that is occurring in some ways without us even recognizing, but a shift that needs to happen in order for our planet to survive and for our children to survive in a healthy way. And this is a shift to a caring economy, to an economic system that supports the work of those who do the caregiving in society, that reflects the accurate measure of the enormous contribution of caring to our economic national wealth and our human well-being and our economic success. Things like tax credits for childcare, paid family leave, higher wages for geriatric care, support for caring businesses. These are real tangible things that we need to recognize and to greater value in society in order to ensure the health and wealth of our nations. And Dr. Iser will be the keynote speaker at the annual Women's Symposium in March. And we welcome your phone calls with questions or comments, 805-781-3875. Vet, is that your name? You're on the air. Are you there? Oh, and if you could please hold, we'll get to you. Thought we had a phone call for you, Dr. Iser. Hopefully they'll call back. 805-781-3875 is the number. So this idea of the caring economy, and I find it a fascinating conversation to have because I work as an educator, and I tell my students quite often, you know, if it weren't for the work of my partner, my husband, who's doing the resource work and bringing in the income that supports our family, I couldn't afford to be a teacher at the university. I'd have to supplement my income as a real estate agent or, you know, something else that pays better. And that's unfortunate. And I'm just one person. And I know that our teachers all over the country are facing pay inequality with the administration and struggling to keep up with the economy. And they're doing our most valued work in raising our children through education. And then as you talked about the caregivers who do early childhood education. So how do we raise the esteemed value of the people doing the caring work in our culture? How do we do that?
Well, it's really a systemic interactive process. It is really only as the status of women rises that the status and value of these activities rises. And you'll see that very vividly in the nations that, according to the World Economic Forum's Gender Gap Report, every year are in the top, you know, have the lowest gender gaps. And I'm talking about nations like Norway, Sweden, Finland. These nations at the beginning of the 20th century were so poor that there were famines. You know, whole states, Minnesota in the United States, were populated by people fleeing hunger. Mm-hmm. Today, they not only have the lowest gender gaps, but they also regularly rank in the highest tiers of the World Economic Forum's Global Competitiveness Report. Why? Because they invested in their human capacity, in their human capital. Along with the higher status of women have come more caring policies, universal health care, high-quality child care, all government-supported, paid, generous paid parental leave for both mothers and fathers, of course. So what we're talking about are interactive dynamics, not simple linear causes and effects. And now these are not ideal nations, and they are tied into the, you know, the larger global economy, and there are issues because of that. But basically they have low poverty rates and a generally high standard of living for all, and their kids do very well in comparative exams worldwide. In other words, as I write in The Real Wealth of Nations, caring pays, and it pays in dollars and cents. And I think we have to use that argument if we're going to make inroads. In fact, we're doing a congressional briefing shortly after on the 24th of March in D.C., called Capitalism and Care, Can They Be Partners? It's an educational process, isn't it?
Well, and it does, and it sounds like this is not revolutionary in trying to overturn anything or anyone, but it's a shift, a nonviolent shift in just a revisioning of how we value wealth in our country. And that if we're going to give lip service to this idea that our children are our greatest resource and that the caregivers are, you know, giving and supporting our greatest assets, our elderly, our children, that we have to do more than just talk about how important it is, but put our money where our mouth is as a culture. And I guess it sounds like having a way to monetize almost the value of this work is the only way we're going to make that shift.
Well, it's interesting because some people, of course, say, well, it should just be done because people, you know, out of love, and besides,
right.
it's fulfilling work. Well, they don't seem to realize how silly that argument is, you know, like being a movie actor or a baseball star that gets millions, right, and really enjoys the work, too, and finds it meaningful. They think that's okay, but somehow this, quote, women's work, oh, women are supposed to do it for free,
right,
which condemns women to where they are globally, to being the mass of the poor and the poorest of the poor along with their children. So if we're serious, really, about breaking through cycles of poverty, this is what we have to address.
And this is a conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, joined by my guest, Dr. Rian Eisler, author of The Chalice and the Blade, and her latest book, The Real Wealth of Nations, Creating a Caring Economy. And we'll be back to take your calls. With a Reluctant Therapist on your public radio station, KCBX. And I am honored to have Dr. Rian Eisler with me today. We're getting ready for her visit here to the Central Coast to be the keynote speaker for the Central Coast Annual Women's Symposium. Her talk will be titled, What is Good for Women is Good for the World. And we're chatting today about this shift that we're trying to make to a caring economy that values the work of the caregivers in our culture as much as it values the work that runs the world through oil and gas and production. The reproductive work as well as the productive work might be a way of addressing it. And we'd love you to join our conversation, 805-781-3875. Vet, you're on the air. You're a student of Dr. Eisler's.
Yes, thank you. I took the Community Advocates Program last summer with Dr. Eisler and the Center for Partnership Studies, and then in the fall, the Cultural Transformation course. And I'm a traditional storyteller, and I was just completely engaged and passionate about what this story could do for us if we actually understood this as a story, the idea of caring economy and partnership culture. And as part of the work for the classes, I held a caring economy conversation in San Luis last September, and we had men and women who were all actually very engaged community activists who joined in. And one of the things that was really stood out was how strongly everyone agreed that the strict gender roles have really contributed to the harmful, you know, dominator power in the culture. And also I wanted to just ask Dr. Eisler to talk a little bit about this idea. When we talk about a partnership culture, we often kind of picture everyone sitting in a circle singing Kumbaya. And I know that Dr. Eisler has talked about it not being a flat system, and I think it's a really important part of the story. So thank you.
Thank you for your question, Vet. Were you able to hear her, Dr. Eisler?
Yes, of course, and I'm delighted that you brought that up. I really appreciate it. This is really the configuration of the partnership and domination systems, as you know from having studied with me and with others who are teaching and using this work and this new conceptual framework. we're not talking about simplistic things like having, as you say, a completely flat organization, which really doesn't work. I mean, we need parents, we need teachers, we need managers, we need leaders. So there have to be hierarchies, okay? And the difference, and it's a huge difference, between the partnership and domination system is not that one is flat and the other one has hierarchies, but it's the difference between, and we have to coin new words, really, between what I've called hierarchies of domination and hierarchies of actualization. Mm-hmm. And we are moving, I mean, even in the corporate literature, for example, you read today about the manager no longer being the cop or controller, but somebody who inspires others, who guides, who facilitates. Well, that's more of the hierarchy of actualization. In other words, yes, if you have a for-profit business, it has to survive. But we're finding, again, that a partnership structure of hierarchies of actualization where power is used not to disempower but to empower others is actually more efficient. And we also, of course, really want a system where in the hierarchy of domination, which is, you know, you either do as I say or else, and in a very rigid domination system like in ISIS or the European Middle Ages, you know, that means death, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But where accountability, where respect, where benefit doesn't just flow from the bottom up, but also from the top down. And this is really very, very important. So we have a whole new vocabulary springing out about parenting, for example, being authoritative, mm-hmm. because children do need guidelines and they do need limits, rather than authoritarian. Mm-hmm. We're finding our way. We're groping. Mm-hmm. But it is towards the partnership side of the continuum.
Thank you for your call, Vet. Yeah, I love the comment of we're groping. You know, it's not a pretty transition. Nothing is pretty and nothing is without pain and growth in uncomfortable ways to get to something new. It's kind of like parenting, right? Where there's a lot of groping that we do for the right way to be with our children and the best way to provide for them and the best way to support their growth. And this idea of authoritative parenting isn't a new idea, but I think in our efforts to build self-esteem and to make things equal and to understand this partnership, we've lost our way a little bit in parenting, that a lot of people try to be too friendly with their children without providing guidance. So what I'm hearing you say is that this caring economy is not about just everyone in a free-for-all doing whatever they like, that we still have structure, that we still have a hierarchy of some sort, but it's a hierarchy of partnership.
It's a hierarchy of actualization, mm-hmm. and really, because, I mean, power, you know, the title, the chalice and the blade, mm-hmm. These are metaphors for two ways of looking at power. We all know the blade, you know, it's the power to control, to dominate, to, if you will, take life. Mm-hmm. But the chalice is also a very, very important power. It's the power to give life, to nurture life, to illuminate life. And as I said, it's always a matter of degree, but we have to also get away from these simplistic ideas. For example, another clarification I'm constantly having to make, which is that a partnership system is not mm-hmm. just the difference between a partnership and domination system is not that there's cooperation in the partnership system and there isn't in the domination system. Look, monopolies cooperate. Terrorists cooperate, invading armies cooperate. I mean, it is much more nuanced. Mm-hmm. There is, and there's also competition in the partnership system, but it's much more based on achievement, on excellence. And we're reading about this, but it's all in bits and pieces. And what this work really provides, be it in economics or be it in organizational development, be it in families, is an integrated framework, a new paradigm, if you'll pardon, you know, that paradigm has been ground into the ground. But that's what it is.
Mm-hmm. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett with my guest, Dr. Rian Eisler. We're talking about what is good for women is good for the world and this need to shift to a caring economy. And you're welcome to join the conversation, 805-781-3875. Rogan, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind today?
Well, I wanted to hear Dr. Eisler talk about other species, in a sense, because it seems that we could develop an economy that honors people and doesn't have gender oppression, but would still continue to lead towards mass extinction of species. In fact, some cases, I think we see that kind of economy developing, and I wondered what she might have to say about that.
How does the caring economy take into consideration the caring for the planet and the other inhabitants, Dr. Eisler?
Oh, very, very definitely. And I would like to propose that, again, we have to connect the dots here because, you know, we speak of our Mother Earth, right? That's a very ancient tradition, isn't it? You know, the honoring of our great mother, of our Mother Earth. And we've lost sight of that. But it didn't happen, you know, recently. It's just that high technology combined with an ethos of domination and conquest, you know, like the once hallowed conquest of nature, right?
Mm-hmm.
That is what's doing us in. It goes way, way back. And it really even goes back before the Old Testament, you know, which writes, I mean, about man having dominion over every creature, you know, that crawleth on the earth, including women, of course. You know, men are supposed to dominate women. It goes way back. We have clues. For example, there's an old Babylonian myth called the Enuma Elish, which is a very clear clue to a shift, where a new war god, Marduk, really kills and dismembers the old mother goddess Tiamat, presumably doing this, creating earth and water, always idealizing the process, of course, of destroying the feminine and destroying the veneration, really, of caring, of nurture.
So once we had that in place, once we had that shift, then we moved towards where we are today with this more global destruction and destruction of the species, the mass extinction. And I don't know if this is your question, Rogan, but is there a way to shift to a protective economy as well as a caring economy, you know, because it seems that people, it's the monetization of everything, right? The taking of resources and the taking of land. How do we change the cultural value or I don't know, measure of wealth in less measurement of gathering all the things we can and the idea of gathering what we need?
Well, I don't think it's only monetization. I really have to disagree with that. You know, the invention of money was actually a very clever thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's certainly easier to have a transaction than trying to exchange a sheep for a bale of hay, you know, or for whatever. You know, it's really a technical invention. For example, deforestation is not new. I mean, this goes way, way back to other domination systems earlier. In fact, it was probably one of the factors in this earlier climate change where herders, you know, kept cutting down trees for pastures, you know, for their flock. We're really talking about a different perspective, a different way of looking. I was invited, for example, to speak to the United Nations General Assembly in a session called Harmony with Nature, and I pointed out that you can't just tack on harmony with nature to a fundamentally imbalanced system based on, you know, man over man over woman, race over race, religion over religion. It's all part of the same domination system.
And so I guess, and Rogan, are you still there?
Yes. Well, I just, when you talk in terms of the real world of corporations and people all wanting to make money and have jobs, it seems that there's a, within that, there's no value put on a lot of aspects of what you might want to value and how to put that in. I mean, human beings have been exploiting environment all along. Now there's 7 billion of us, and if we're going to exploit the environment and the extent that we have been, if we don't want to do that, if we want to achieve what you're trying to say, we're going to have to put some basic changes in the economic system that affects the decisions of corporations and so forth.
Well, that's exactly what we're working on. And you have to, as I said, economics is about what is valued and rewarding what is valued or penalizing what is harmful. We haven't got that system. And like a caring economy really starts from a very fundamental premise that what we need are economic measurements, and we are working, and we just launched new economic metrics, what we call social wealth economic indicators, which really show two things. They show where do we as a nation compared to other developed nations stand in terms of our human capacity development, and it's not a pretty picture. And what investments do we have to make to change that, to have better outcomes? So one thing we need are new economic measurements. Mm-hmm. We also need new economic rules of the game, practices that give visibility and value to the most important human work, the work of caring for people starting in early childhood and throughout the lifespan, and caring for nature. Now, the fact that we are moving into a technological age where so many old human functions, human jobs, are being taken over by automation, by robotics, artificial intelligence, in one way is terribly dislocating. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's causing a great deal of pain. On the other hand, if we keep moving in that direction, and really we will, because once a technology is like a genie, once it's out of the bottle, it's there. We have here really an opportunity and, as a matter of fact, a demand to reevaluate what is productive work. Mm-hmm. That's the premise of this work. So, and I want to say something about corporations. I mean, when we launched the social wealth economic indicators, one of the people on our panel was a senior vice president from a Fortune 500 corporation who gets it, who got it, that, that we have to invest in our people. So it isn't like everybody in that world likes it or wants it. It's that, as you say, we have to change the rules and thereby the structures and the reward system. I mean, why shouldn't we, for example, penalize just speculation? It's been proposed before. I mean, it doesn't add any value. Why shouldn't we reward companies that do have paid parental leave, that do have more humane policies? All of this can be done.
And I think the conversation is where we start. And thank you for your call, Rogan. The conversation is where we start. And when we have enough of these conversations, we start to have a cultural shift in perspective, which is why I think it's so important that we get our college students and our high school students and our children in general, our 20-somethings, invested in this conversation, because they have the numbers on the planet to change the course of history if they can figure out how to use all their technology, right, to come together to demand this change in how we envision economy and envision wealth and envision those things that we value. And I think, you know, underneath all of this is this fundamental issue of how do we revalue and esteem the role of women in culture to a place where there is more balance, where the work that is traditionally seen as being woman's work is valued as the most important work that we do. And just the fundamental possibilities of a new world order where everyone values the same thing, which is the caring for each other, would shift the whole course of history. This is a conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, joined by my guest, Dr. Rian Eisler. And Dr. Eisler, can you talk a little bit about the Caring Economy campaign and how people can get involved?
Well, let me just very quickly address something that was brought up, which was population. Again, let's connect the dots. It's really only by raising the status of women that you have a ghost of a chance of managing population, I mean, other than the traditional means of famine and war and so on. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I mean, we're really back to an understanding of the centrality of so-called gender issues to everything in the social system, which takes me directly to the caring economy. Because, of course, what we're talking about, as I said, is really making visible this hidden system of gendered valuations and really showing how irrational and really pathological it is, and that it's not only bad for women and men, but that in the end it's bad for a sound economy. So what we have are our new indicators, our social wealth economic indicators, and you can find out about them, by the way, by going to caringeconomy.org. We also have wonderful webinars that who phoned in, and I did recognize who it was, has spoken about them. And everybody, we have representatives in these online webinars now from 17 nations worldwide. I mean, this is a movement, and I really want to invite our listeners. Go to caringeconomy.org, enroll. We have a new Caring Economy Advocates course starting on March 4, and there are only 4 places left because we keep the cohort small. Enroll. Become part of this, because the only way that we moved from the European Middle Ages to today was through human agency, okay? Mm-hmm. And it's up to us. But we need a new way of thinking and a new way of convincing others that, yes, that we're not talking about something adversarial here. We're talking about changes that, in the end, benefit us all.
A way that we can actually maybe survive as a species and as a planet and not just bounce along. Jeremy, you're on the air. What's on your mind today?
That I appreciate working towards a balance, but I give all women permission to go ahead and restore the matriarchy first. you guys have earned it.
I don't think we ever had a matriarchy, Jeremy.
Well, that's
it's a misunderstanding that
true.
When women have higher status, that means that they're in control. It's part of the dominator thinking. But thank you, I mean, for your vote of confidence in women.
I also was reminded of a quote I've heard and have repeated often, that if women ruled the world, we'd all be still living in grass huts. And I've repeated that, and people find it insulting, but I've always held it up as the ideal, because women would not have allowed us to devastate the ecology and build big phallic monstrosities and things like that. I'm wondering if you find that belittling or insulting or anything like that.
Thank you, Jeremy.
I don't find it belittling or insulting, but I don't think that we want to go back to grass huts. I don't think we need to go back to grass huts. I think what we need is to find ways of using technology, including advanced technology, in a partnership rather than domination system. I mean, technology per se is values neutral. It's how you use it. You know, you can use gas to heat a room, which certainly helps people not to freeze, or as the Nazis did, you can use gas for mass killings. I mean, the same is true of robotics. You can use it to free people from onerous and repetitive mental and physical work, or you can use it as a means of control. It's the underlying social system, and I again want to emphasize, we have to really focus more attention on the foundational issues. How are childhood relations structured? I mean, from neuroscience, we know that that affects our brain, how it functions. Gender relations, same thing. It's what children first observe. If they have a mental map of relations where one has to dominate and the other one is dominated, and then they think there's only two alternatives. You either dominate or you're dominated. They need to see and experience partnership alternatives. Economics, of course, we've already talked a lot, and stories. Stories, we live by stories. What is our story about economics? What is our story about human nature? What is possible for us? Those are the foundations. Politics follows those.
Thank you, Jeremy, for your call. And I think that's a great point, the idea that politics and policy follow the will of the people. And I think the way we're educating our people is what is promoting the continuation of the dominator economy and the dominator system that we live in. And so I think so much of the thrust has to be in getting this story, this message into our universities, where we are training the next generation of worker bees who are looking at this economy and looking at their choice of careers or work based on what's going to bring in the most economic value to them. And I think that's what's unfortunate, because you have young people who are spending quite a bit of money to get a college education who are going to go into the caring sector as teachers, as child care workers, as geriatric workers in these very important positions, service areas in the economy that are not supported and are undervalued. And so I don't know how we continue to shift that conversation to get this whole shift in mindset about what is of true value, because everyone will say we value human capital, but no one understands that we can actually have a healthy economy by supporting human capital. Dr. Eisleid, one last quick thing with a couple minutes left. The conversation that is in many people's radar right now is about pay inequity, and that this conversation about equal pay for women and men seems to me to be important, but I don't know if that's the primary issue. How do we address the pay inequality, and is that where we should have our focus, or is it preventing us from focusing on deeper issues? And we have about a minute to go.
Well, I don't think that it's preventing us. I think it's not an either or. It's a both. Mm-hmm. And but I think you're absolutely right that if we are talking about pay equality within the present system, where you're supposed to simply have nobody out, no children, no elderly to care for, nothing, you know, where you only exist for your job, that's crazy. I mean, it doesn't work in the post-industrial age. So, but I want to get back to something you said, which is getting it into universities. We have a new journal, the Interdisciplinary Journal of Partnership Studies, and you can look it up. It's housed at the University of Minnesota, and I want to invite everybody with an academic bent, although it's also for practitioners, to really not only read it, but to think about contributing to it.
Dr. Eisleid, I hate to cut you off, but we do have to wrap things up. And I want to remind everyone that if you would like to hear more of this conversation, please attend the Central Coast Annual Women's Symposium on March the 14th. It's a Saturday. Dr. Eisleid will be addressing what is good for women is good for the world. Dr. Eisleid, thank you for your time today. I look forward to seeing you on the 14th, and I look forward to continuing this conversation. And thank you for supporting Public Radio. This is a conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. I'll talk to you next week. Thank you.